This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning and welcome to the programme. Now, most of the newspapers and a lot of social media is awash with photos from a boozy Sunday lunch hosted by J.K. Rowling this weekend just gone. The Harry Potter author brought together a particular group of feminists and activists as a new campaign is launched called Respect My Sex ahead of the local elections. The women at the lunch, which included Professor Kathleen Stock, who resigned from Sussex University after a campaign against her views on gender and sex, and also the campaigner, Maya Forstatter, who won, I'm sure some of you will remember, the first part of a case, which means that gender-critical views are a protected belief under the Equality Act, are united over what they think defines a woman in a time when women's and trans rights are being debated. Well, today I'm joined by someone else who was at that lunch, the Labour MP Rosie Duffield, who has come into conflict with her own party's policies on this issue. The local elections are coming up, of course, on May the 5th, and this new cross-party campaign called Respect My Sex If You Want My Ex, set up by women's rights groups, is urging you as voters to ask several key questions, the top being, what is a woman? Followed by, what is more important, sex or gender? Followed by asking a candidate, as and when you may meet them, if you do, if they support single-sex spaces. Are those questions any of the ones that you would ask a local candidate? That's what I wanted to ask you today, a question about a set of questions. Do you care? Is that top of mind? Let's say a local candidate of any party comes to your door or you manage to speak to them, I don't know, at a hustings or in the local area where you are. Is this what's going to come up? Or is it more about the bins? Dog poo, local transport links, the roads, the cost of everything in your life at the moment? Or if you do care about this, are you going to go there? Are you going to ask local candidates for their definition of a woman? Or if you are interested in this area, would the question perhaps be different? Be about maybe their take on inclusion and trans rights? What are your thoughts on this campaign as the local elections come? And where are you with the types of questions you would ask? You may think, I'm not going to see anyone. I don't even know how to get involved in this. But I want to hear if you are going to and if you are able to, what are the questions top of mind? Very interested to get your take on this. You can text me here at Woman's Hour on 84844. A bit of democracy in action, as it were, right now on Woman's Hour. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or email me those questions that you do want to ask through our website. Also on today's programme, the actor Anya Taylor-Joy, who you might know as Beth Harmon from the chess series on Netflix, The Queen's Gambit. Well, she's now starring an extremely bloody Viking epic, The Northman. More about that to come. I'll also be joined by the artist Celia Paul and be asking her why she's written a book of letters to a fellow artist who cannot reply. And we'll have the latest on the court battle between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. But first, to Rosie Duffield. The Labour MP has just joined me in the studio. She was at that lunch this weekend hosted by J.K. Rowling. A brief scan of her Twitter feed shows her having retweeted a photo of her and the author together with the caption from J.K. Rowling beneath it saying, "Two ex-single mums now united for women's rights." Rosie is a Labour MP for Canterbury. She came to prominence with her views over gender and sex in 2020 on Twitter when she posted, in reply to Piers Morgan, no less, a question, "I'm a transphobe for knowing that only women have a cervix?" Well, fast forward a year, she didn't feel she was able to attend her own party conference after death threats and abuse on the matter. And when her party leader, Sir Keir Starmer, was asked about the issue, he said it was wrong to say, quote, "only women have a cervix." Rosie Duffield, good morning.
Hi, Emma.
Those pictures, let's start there. There's this lunch that's gone on at the weekend, I believe on Sunday, a delayed Christmas lunch at quite a gathering of a particular group of women. What was that like?
It was great fun. I mean, we've all been in contact for the last couple of years anyway and met in sort of different groups or singly, but we haven't all been able to come together. So it was really good fun to be able to do that.
And the purpose of it?
Just to say hello to each other and to celebrate, you know, that we've got a great friendship, that we're supporting each other, what we've been through, and to discuss this campaign and other things like that, really.
And also, of course, the sharing. I mean, it could have been a private lunch. It obviously was a private lunch, but it's been quite striking on the sharing of the images from it. You are a group of women who have lived and breathed, I think it's safe to say, social media, sharing, using that space to share views. What do you think that message is to send that image out?
I was really hesitant about doing that because I just thought, you know, we all know the kind of abuse that we could have got and perhaps have been getting. I don't know. I haven't been seeing that. But I think the attitude at the end of the day was, sod it, let's do this and let's just announce that we're sort of friends no matter what, that we're still able to laugh and have fun. We're just a group of ordinary women meeting up and doing what we do, talking about the things that matter to us.
Well, were your particular group of women, I suppose, united over some of these views that I was just outlining rather than, you know, randomly selected?
Yeah.
It would be a fair way of putting it. And when you say you were hesitant about sharing those sorts of images, was it a decision amongst the group? JK's been posting a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have posted anything unless Jo had. And she obviously decided that was OK. I think she's been quite vocal on social media in the last few weeks. And, you know, why not? Why not? Why should we? You know, it's
I'm not saying either way.
No, I know you're
not. Striking.
I think this is just what occurred to me. You know, why not? And, you know, we, as politicians, we're so programmed to just accept or assume that we're going to get abuse. And you hesitate before you make any decision like that. So I'd put it on my Instagram, just a tiny little thing, which has got a small following on my personal Instagram, and left it at that. And then I saw it all over social media. We were all getting calls from journalists all day yesterday asking the story about us. It must have been a slow news day, I guess, about us having lunch. But yeah, I mean, we did
that.
She's
one of our most successful authors. She has taken a stand on this particular issue from her point of view. And it is quite a group of, it's a very accomplished group of women and also women who've been activists, I suppose, in the space for a long time. It's not necessarily a slow news day. It's quite an image.
Yeah. I understand people's interest and, you know, but we were in that space, just ordinary women talking about the things that matter to us.
And we're getting some messages in coming in right now about what people do care about with regards to the local elections coming up. And I wondered, as you are supporting this particular campaign, which I just want to stress at this point, is cross-party.
Absolutely.
And I should also say, you know, if you need a list of the candidates or anybody available in your area, there's a full list on the BBC website. We're obeying all those rules in a run-up to a local election. But what evidence do you have that people do want to ask these sorts of questions of local candidates?
I've got personal direct evidence. So in the general election of 2019, one or possibly sometimes two things came up on the door. Jeremy Corbyn, anti-Semitism, and in my area, Brexit. And the third thing that absolutely knocked me sideways was that I had three or four women stopping me, asking if they could have a private conversation, and what was happening in schools came up. There was one woman who was a teacher, one was a social worker, one was a parent who said, "I'm convinced that my child is gay, and yet there seems to be this kind of movement where it isn't okay just to be gay." And that sparked a conversation. That's a different discussion. But I was astonished that they felt they had to ask me in private to talk about these things. And that was before I had said a single solitary word in public or liked a tweet or anything. These were women who wanted to talk to me about that. And I was really surprised. It wasn't tax, it wasn't bins, it wasn't anything like that. It was this issue. Because, as I said, only two things dominated that election.
From your perspective?
Yeah.
OK, so there's a message here that's just come straight in. "I do not care
at all about the definition of a woman. Let people live their lives. Poverty, injustice, climate change, corruption, war, children living in homes that do not have enough money to eat or heat their homes. These are the issues that directly affect women, not a trans woman needing the toilet.
That's absolutely right. Some people don't care, you know, in quotes, about it, but an awful lot of women do. We can care about all those things. And as a politician, that's what I do every single day. You know, in one day, we'll be covering fuel poverty, Ukrainian refugees, and women's rights. You know, we can do all of those things at the same time.
In terms of your party's position on these questions, what is a woman according to Labour?
That's a bit confusing, isn't it? I think it depends.
Well, you're a Labour MP.
Well, I know what I think a woman is, which is a biological human adult female.
Using the dictionary definition?
Yeah.
I'm asking that, of course, because the thing that sort of set a lot of things in train after my interview on International Women's Day with the Shadow Women's Minister, Annelise Dodds, who was on the programme, I asked her about this. And I've got a range of quotes that sort of came after that interview. But when I asked her, she said there were different definitions legally and that it depends on what the context is, surely. You're chair of Labour's Women's Parliamentary Labour Party, I believe, still.
Yeah.
What is the actual line from the party on this?
I think it's been really unclear, I have to be honest. And I think now that I've heard Keir say that it is an adult human female, and I think Annalisa has since been clearer herself on that. But I mean, I'm an adult human female. I don't necessarily need my party to have a line on it that, you know, I'm an MP in that party. And that's what I think.
You do need them to have a line. You've just
support
a campaign where you want people to take some of the valuable time they've got with a local candidate and ask them this question.
I would like them to have that very clear, simple, straightforward answer. I think most people, most women, just appreciate that kind of straightforward honesty rather than all this umming and ahhing.
So there isn't a line, you would say, at the moment on the party?
I don't know. I'm not in the sort of inner circle of the front bench or the shadow cabinet. I don't know if there is a line. I'm not someone who, as a backbencher, reads the lines particularly, but that's my line.
No, but you are the chair of... If I was chair of Labour Women's Parliamentary Party...
Yeah. I've asked the question a few times. It seems to be a bit confused. There's always a sort of slight quantifying of that answer, and I would just like it to be more straightforward.
And in terms of Labour's official position around the Gender Recognition Act, that it needs to be reformed is the position, but that also single-sex spaces need to be protected.
Yeah.
What is the issue with those two positions alongside each
other? There are questions on, I think Keir Starmer and Annalisa have said that they want to make it easier for people who transition to self-ID and also make sure that they reinforce their protection of single-sex spaces. And there is a biting point there where we do have to talk about both those things and how they can coexist.
And do you have faith in the party that you're in to be able to do that?
I think we're getting there. The conversations are getting easier and I think they're starting to listen. But it's a bit of a shame that it's taken so long and that hasn't been so clear from the beginning, and that various groups haven't been heard or listened to who've been trying to talk about this to the party and within the party for at least 3 years.
Okay, so because I suppose when I'm looking through what people have said recently from your party, you know, Keir Starmer has recently refused to answer when asked, can a woman have a penis? Yvette Cooper's refused three times, of course, a member of the shadow cabinet, refused three times to define what a woman is and says she's not going to go down a rabbit hole in it. I've quoted what Annalise Dodds said on this exact programme. It does not sound like it is any clearer.
That doesn't sound great, does it? I mean, I understand why individual people may not want to enter this arena because it is scary and we do get abuse, but as
why
a party...
Why is it scary?
I think because whatever you say as a woman politician, well, as a politician, you're kind of torn apart anyway. But this particular issue has been really contentious and there's a lot of hurt attached on both sides, a lot of very high emotion and feeling. Lots of people who are very invested in it get very upset if you accidentally offend them or offend them by not thinking about how you're speaking. But I wouldn't call it a rabbit hole. And, you know, my point of view is, of course, a woman can't have a penis.
In that position, though, and in talking about that, you talk about feelings and people being hurt. Do you understand why some trans people, trans women in particular, over recent days where the Prime Minister has come out very clearly with his views, for instance, saying about biological males shouldn't be able to play in female categories of sport. There's also been a double U-turn from the government with regards to conversion therapy, leaving trans people available essentially to that therapy. Do you understand why some of those individuals do feel like there has been a change in mood and an attack?
Yeah, of course I do. They have to really listen to what we're saying. Nobody I know or have met in this movement or in my party wants to leave trans rights, you know, on a bonfire or hurt trans people or make them disadvantaged. Absolutely no way. Imagine going through that. I can't. I could say that you probably can't as well. It must be horrendous and scary, incredibly courageous to go through the public decision to change gender. I can't imagine how hard that is. But at the same time, what I came to politics to do was to protect women's rights, to speak about women's rights, to not shy away from speaking about women's rights. And that's my area of expertise, if you like. And I think the two can coexist. We just have to be able to have those conversations.
I suppose it's also about the tone of it and it being respectful. I mean, I was just looking back at some of your activity on Twitter and you were investigated by party officials after liking a tweet by a US rapper. Is that right?
Yeah.
Curtis Tripp. The tweet said, "Trans people are mostly heterosexuals cosplaying as the opposite sex and as gay."
I think that was really unfortunate. I probably shouldn't have liked that aspect of the tweet. That's not really what I was liking. He was just yet another gay man that I'm connected to on Twitter who said that they found the term queer deeply offensive. And, you know, I'm 50. A lot of people my age who I grew up with, went to Pride with, who are called the word queer, I find it even hard saying it actually, find that really debasing, really insulting. It was spat in their faces. And I can absolutely empathise with not everyone embracing that word. It's, again, I mean, there's so many divides on this. This is an age thing partly, isn't it? You know, younger people newer to this discussion on rights are probably embracing those words. But to people my age, it's still an insult and it's still deeply hurtful. And I think that's what Curtis meant. So I didn't mean to cause offence by liking that tweet, but I was agreeing with him that it isn't necessarily that straightforward.
A message here: I absolutely do care about the issue of single-sex spaces. I will be asking any candidate who knocks at my door, if we cannot name our sex, how can we organise and provide services for those who need them? Everything else comes from that, says Polly. Another one here: my name is Philippa. Rosie is my MP. I have no cervix. I had a full hysterectomy 5 years ago. I want to ask why protection of women's spaces excludes trans women who are more at risk of violence or murder than any category. They need to feel safe too. Surely her wishes to protect women's spaces is to exclude violent, dangerous men. Why is the fear and the hatred projected in this way? Why is the fear and hatred projected onto one of the most persecuted, othered groups? What would you say to that?
She's absolutely right to want to protect that group of people, and so do I. But we can't. We have laws against rape, because the definition of rape is really that there's one thing that's used as a weapon in rape, and that is penises. Not every man is a rapist, but we have to have those laws. And not every biologically intact trans person, in fact, very few of them, I would imagine, are going to wish to harm females. But we have to protect people. We have to have these conversations. We're not ready to kind of decide that yet, I don't think. We've gone from 0 to 60 in a millisecond via social media. We have to be able to have those conversations and raise those fears without being called prejudiced or cancelled just for asking the questions. I don't know enough about this area. None of us do yet. We have to be able to talk about it.
And yet there's nervousness about talking about it.
Yes. Yeah, because of being
cancelled. Are you nervous talking about it now?
Labelled. Yes, completely. Yeah, I'm always nervous about talking about it. But
because there's been personal cost?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm, you know, slightly persona non grata within my own party. I know that I've been considered an embarrassment to the party by talking about it, and they would much rather I didn't, you know, but I'm not going to, because I didn't come here to necessarily just spout the Labour Party lines. I have thousands and thousands of women contacting me and men who are really concerned that we can't just have this conversation. That's what it's about.
You've been called, and other sex-based rights campaigners have been branded, dinosaurs by colleagues in your party.
That was the comedy gift that keeps on giving. I mean, you know, David Lammy is a friend, and I don't think he saw that coming at all. But, you know, I've been sent lots of dinosaur brooches and badges and people dressing up as dinosaurs. And I've got a T-shirt of me and Joe Rowling dressed as dinosaurs. You know, I mean, it's, I don't think it was meant the way it came across. But
persona non grata in your own party.
Mm,
you're still slightly chair of Labour's Women's Parliamentary Party, and you don't seem to agree with what your leader's saying. You seem to agree with what Boris Johnson is saying.
I think Boris was really clear. He was asked a question in PMQs a couple of Wednesdays ago, and he's obviously been really thinking about and reading about this issue.
Or weaponising the culture war.
Well, maybe he is weaponising it, but then why have the Labour Party allowed it to be weaponised?
I don't know. That's your strategy. You keep losing elections.
It's not my strategy. I'm not involved in the strategy. I'm just a mere backbencher. But, you know, I think I did try and warn the party that this was coming. And I think the feeling was that it was a niche issue, that it would go away.
Why?
It hasn't gone away.
Well, some are also saying this is an incredibly niche issue.
It's not to the thousands of women that contact me.
But I also, we have millions of listeners, and I also have to respond. I mean, I got a message the other day saying that somebody didn't even understand one of my interviews that I've done on this because they can't follow some of the lingo
Fair
on
enough.
It. You know, there's a lot that people have to get their heads around. Why are you still an MP for the Labour Party?
I believe in the Labour Party as a movement. It's never just about the state.
You've just denigrated the previous leader, and you also don't agree with this leader on what you say is one of the most important issues at the moment that isn't a niche issue. So why are you staying in a movement that has made you a person, you know, somebody that's not somebody who's respected or valued?
I think it's not just a party or a movement for the few at the top. It is the biggest party of the left in Western Europe. There's something like 500,000 members. I'm here to represent my constituents, and the members that I know are really engaged in this issue. That's women councillors, people who signed what we call the Labour Women's Declaration, which is a group within the party.
But you're standing of women. No, but I understand all of that, that it's big, right?
Mm.
But you're standing there under a banner,
yeah,
under a leader who won't say if a woman can have a penis or not, and you are at odds with that position.
Yeah. Well, there are lots of women like me within the party, councillors, members, and some MPs who agree with me.
So
we're hoping to shift the position, I suppose.
So you would never join, you would never resign from the Labour Party over this?
I have to be honest that I've thought about it. I'm not in that space yet. If a woman like me, who is a single mum, on the tax credits created by the last Labour government, is beginning to doubt my allegiance to the party, and I am a typical Labour voter, then I think probably the Labour Party need to listen to that.
But you've been doubting it for some time. I suppose that's what I'm saying. And if there was a moment to go to the Conservatives, it's now on this issue.
There are lots of issues for me personally that mean I couldn't just join the Conservative Party. Immigration, Brexit.
All right, and any other party then? Have you thought about
defecting? There are no other parties that appeal to me in that sense. And if you look at all political parties, the main ones have a huge broad church of views. And that's great. You know, I'm not the only Labour MP who feels like I do about this issue.
I suppose where and my experience of talking to MPs and talking to those who work in politics is that where sometimes listeners don't understand, and the public have asked a lot of questions I've seen over the years, is when they hear an MP come on who does not agree with their party and their party line, does not agree with their leader of their party on the issue that they say they care and are campaigning on and are most vocal about, and yet they continue to stay a member of that party.
Yeah.
Why not do the brave thing and resign the Labour Party right here, right now on Woman's Hour?
I absolutely, completely understand that point of view. I had similar over anti-Semitism, which dominated from the day I was elected to the 2019 election and a bit beyond. And people used to say to our Jewish women MPs, why are you still in the Labour Party? There are lots of personal reasons. Everyone has to answer to themselves as well as their constituents and their local party. But for me, I don't believe the conversation has ended. I think it's just started. I think there is a shift. I'm hoping to be part of that conversation changing. I know there are plenty of women in the party who think that this is still the party for them. We just need to change on that. I've seen a change over anti-Semitism. If I hadn't, I'd have been out of the door.
You saw a change. The electorate didn't go for Jeremy Corbyn.
No, they didn't. And we absolutely deserved that on that issue.
Well, it won't necessarily be about that issue, of course. It may have also just liked what the Conservatives and Boris Johnson
were. Well, that's
true as well. But the point is you didn't affect that change. I suppose I'm saying, with the experience of what happened with Jeremy Corbyn from your perspective, you didn't affect that change. He ran in two elections and it was the public that dealt with that from that perspective. And I suppose, how confident are you, just as our time comes to a close, how confident are you that you can change the Labour position to get it to a place where it can make the definition of a woman as you see it?
I'm quite confident that the groups within the party are now starting to be heard and listened to. I don't know whether I will be personally, but I'm going to keep trying and keep fighting. At the end of the day, I have to keep checking myself if it's the right thing to still do. One day, the answer might be different.
What would be that day? Have you got a kind of thing in your mind?
I think it partly depends on the policies we go forward with into the next election, actually, and the lines that we're told to say. If I absolutely fundamentally disagree with them, I'll have to be honest and say so.
Do you still like politics?
I love politics. My everyday job is brilliant. It's what I always wanted.
I think it's always good to check in with MPs on that point, because as you say, you have the campaigns that you go for, and there are a lot of things that go on behind the scenes because of that. And you yourself have talked about some of the abuse and the threats. I know you've talked at length about that. So today was a bit more of a chance to hear about some of the policy side and the ideas behind it. Rosie Duffield, thank you very much. Labour MP there for Canterbury. A lot of you also, I should say, still getting in touch with us with messages only yesterday over an interview I conducted last week with the trans academic and author Grace Lavery, who, it's safe to say, does have pretty different views to Rosie Duffield that you've just been hearing. That interview, if you missed it, you can hear on BBC Sound. And of course, just because we've talked about the local elections happening on the 5th of May, England, Scotland and Wales, of course, while in Northern Ireland, voters will elect members to the Northern Ireland Assembly. You can find more information about the candidates standing in your area on the BBC News website. Now, the sequel to Johnny Depp and ex-wife Amber Heard's bitter legal battle, if we can call it that, is coming to America, Virginia to be more precise. After losing the first round, a libel trial set in the UK, Depp is suing Heard for $50 million, £38 million, over a piece she wrote in the Washington Post in which she claimed to be a victim of domestic abuse. She is suing back with a $100 million counterclaim against him. His legal team successfully argued that the trial should be held in Virginia, home to two Washington Post offices where the paper is physically published. It's expected to last up to 6 weeks and in some ways will be a rerun of the London trial, exposing many details about their relationship with accusations of abuse aimed at both sides. Well, joining me now, standing outside Fairfax County Circuit Court in Virginia, is the BBC media and arts correspondent David Sillitoe. David, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How did we get here? Go on, tell us.
The court case that took place in London, and I think it's easy to forget, was not a court case between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. It was a court case between Johnny Depp and The Sun. It was an article written by Dan Wooten in which he was described, that is Johnny Depp, as a wife beater. So the case was a libel trial where Johnny Depp was suing The Sun. Amber Heard was brought in as their main witness. Now, it was a 3-week trial. It was, for both sides, you can only say excruciating in the level of detail it revealed about their private lives, their, without doubt, very turbulent and unhappy marriage that they had. But there were 14 separate allegations made in court of assault and abuse. The judge listened in all of that detail, and there was a very long judgment made at the end, and he said that he believed 12 out of those 14 allegations. He said the view that Johnny Depp was a wife beater was substantially true. So that was a major defeat. He was removed from the film Fantastic Beasts. But, you know, he still has work. I mean, it's not the end of his career. And what I think's quite interesting is that I'm standing in front of a court building today, and we've been here since about 4:15 this morning, and we were not the first people in line for the court. There is quite a large number of fans here, people who are supporters of Johnny Depp. There are very few people here supporting Amber Heard. So he has his core group of fans who are committed that somehow an injustice was somehow committed in London, and they believe that here he will, with a jury, be vindicated, that this will be a chance to clear his reputation. So this is what it's about. What's interesting when you chat to the libel lawyers is, of course, that the libel laws in America are rather different than they are in Britain. And it is a rather tougher hill to climb. In the UK, essentially, you have to prove a story is true. Here, it's pretty much the other way around, the burden of proof in the other direction. So it's a pretty tough hill to climb. And of course, there are sort of greater protections for speech in newspapers. So this is one of the reasons why the court case is taking place in Virginia. There are what are known as anti-slap laws. It's complicated, but essentially it means that if you say something in a newspaper and do not, and it's untrue, you have to prove essentially that you knew it was untrue and you were reckless about the truth. So it's a very high bar for it to actually get to court. Virginia, slightly different laws. So it's got to court. There is a jury in place. And they've been told that, well, maybe they're going to be here for up to 7 weeks.
So it's going to be a long case to follow. As you say, many details going to come out. Again, I just thought worth reading out a couple of the sentences from that piece. She says, "I felt the full force of our culture's wrath for women who speak out." This is what Amber Heard wrote. "I had the rare vantage point of seeing in real time how institutions protect men accused of abuse, never mentioning her ex-husband or any alleged perpetrator by name." I suppose, as you've stressed, what will be striking is the fact that this is, again, about libel. It's about the media side of things. It's not actually about the abuse or alleged abuse.
There are many questions. I mean, sitting through the first case in London, what struck you was that the allegations, you were amazed that the police and charges for assault had not been brought at the time. There had been various interactions with the police on certain times, but it had never reached the court. And the fact that it was essentially a libel case in London where a judgment was being made about whether or not what she said was true seemed unusual. And I think the situation here is, as you say, she did not mention Johnny Depp's name. It was an op-ed about her saying she was a victim of domestic violence and that she has spoken up about other people speaking up about it. And she's now facing he has a team of very expensive lawyers, and they are going to go through once again, hour by hour, minute by minute, everything that she has said over the years about her marriage. So it is going to be, for both sides, uncomfortable, but certainly it is her story that is going to be torn apart in court over these next 7 weeks.
And just finally, 120 people approximately on the potential witness list, including some high-profile names, David.
Yes, some very famous names. The people, of course, that they were associating with, many famous friends, James Franco, Paul Bettany, Elon Musk even makes an appearance at one point in it. How many of them will actually appear in court is, yet to be decided. A few of them we understand may have made their witness statements, but certainly it is going to be televised by court TV. So what's very different here is that people will be able to see and hear the evidence for themselves. Also there is a jury involved in this. So it could be a different outcome based on Johnny Depp certainly believes that Amber Heard committed a hoax and he wants the world to know it. And this is a part of this about it is the public nature of this. So there's been a lot of discussion about these anti-slap laws, which is essentially the issue in which very rich, very powerful people can bring litigation against people. And because both sides have to pay in libel in the US, even if you win, you'll still face the costs. A lot of people just fold and say, I'm not going to go any further with this. And here, well, they are going ahead with it. So it's going to be fascinating to watch, but definitely very, very uncomfortable.
David Sillitoe, the BBC Media and Arts correspondent, reporting to us live outside that court, Fairfax County Circuit Court in Virginia, where that battle between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp is going ahead because she didn't fold. She's carrying on, I suppose, with it. That's one way of putting it. And also, as mentioned, can be very distressing and I'm sure very upsetting for a lot of people to see some of the details and hear about what both sides allege went on in that relationship. Now, Anya Taylor-Joy's decision to leave school at 16 to pursue a career in acting has certainly paid off. In 2020, in the first month of its release, a staggering 62 million households watched her play chess prodigy Beth Harmon in the Netflix miniseries The Queen's Gambit. I still need to watch that, I'm going to confess. I do really want to see it as a keen chess player. But more recently, you may have seen her play Gina Grey in the final series of Peaky Blinders. She's also starred in many films, of course, from The Witch to Jane Austen's Emma. But her latest, The Northman, is a brutal and bloody Viking epic that follows a young prince on his quest to avenge his father's murder. Anya plays Olga of the Birch Forest. Just to give you a flavour, here's a clip from the trailer.
Why would he stow away to such a hellish place?
To find what was stolen from me.
And what is that?
The kingdom. You must choose between kindness for your kin or hate for your enemies.
Your strength breaks men's bones. I have the cunning to break their minds.
It's directed by Robert Eggers. No shortage of drama. It stars Alexander Skarsgård, Nicole Kidman, Bjork, and a good friend of Anya Taylor-Joy's, Kate Dickie, who you'll hear referred to in this conversation. I did catch up with Anya Taylor-Joy a few days ago, and I wanted to know what attracted her to this extremely bloody film.
I read the script and it just felt so epic, and I hadn't read something like that ever. You know, it feels like that kind of epic filmmaking had a moment and then has semi-disappeared a little bit, and I was really excited by the prospect of doing all of it for real, because I knew that that's how Rob does it. You know, everything that I was reading was something that we were actually going to go and do in real life with no green screen. And that was a thrill.
In freezing Northern Ireland?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
I mean, just we'll come to that because I'm a person who's always cold. Many women are. But you seem to be able to doing very well in that scenario, not wearing very much and barefoot, it looks like, a lot of the time, as would have been, I suppose, the Viking times. But it's a lot of violence, isn't it? A huge amount.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just, it's part of their culture. I think every time I do something, you know, historically based, I'm always amazed at just how difficult it was to stay alive. Like, truly, just every day, it was such a struggle to live. And it was quite funny because, you know, my first day, I wanted to do all of these lyrical things with my delivery. And then you get into the space and you go, ah, yes, it has to be direct and deep and low, because if you don't get this information across, you're going to die. There's no time to paint a picture with your dialogue. You've got to just kind of get it out.
You're playing an enslaved woman, Olga of the Birch Forest. There's a great line where you're saying to Prince Amleth, you have the strength to break men's bones, but I have the courage to break their minds. It's a great line. Did you enjoy saying that?
Yes, very, very much so.
Spoken from the heart?
Well, absolutely. But I also think you've seen Alex in the movie now. His name is Beowulf. He is a mountain of a man. And I don't think for a second Amleth believes that Olga is anything other than his equal simply because she is so much smaller compared to him. I really feel that in their relationship and throughout the film, you understand that there's a kind of ebb and flow of power in terms of how they can help each other. They really are a team and a duo, and they're both playing to each other's strengths.
And then out of nowhere, Bjork appears. I mean, that's a gift.
How can you make this movie without Bjork?
When I saw her, I was like, of course Bjork's there.
Norse mythology, she just appears. She has to be there.
Honestly, it made quite a lot of sense at that moment. What do we say she's playing? What's her role? She's playing an image in his mind.
Ooh, let's say a guide.
And wearing a lot of feathers. There were some amazing visuals on that. Did you have a chance to talk with her about this?
Yeah, we all spent a lot of time together because this was shot during lockdown. So we all isolated as a little unit and we felt so lucky that we got to be outside. You know, we'd all spent months inside and months away from people and suddenly we got to be outside every single day and that just felt like the biggest gift. I was ecstatic on the set. I loved every second of it.
Although cold, no? Northern Ireland, no shoes.
So here's the thing that I find kind of strange. I really enjoy it. I'm not a complainer. I get literally stuck in with everybody and I see it as my unofficial job to keep everyone's spirits up, because if the tiny blonde girl is not complaining about being in the ocean for the fourth hour in a row, you as the big burly stuntman can't really say anything. You know what I mean? It's like I'm attempting to set a tone of, do not get lost in how quote unquote difficult this is right now. This is a privilege. Like, let's enjoy this.
I like it. You're also setting the standard, right? If you're fine, everyone's got to be fine.
I mean, I would hope so. I don't set out with that intention. I just really enjoy it.
No, but that's wonderful to hear, because as I say, people haven't seen it yet, but it's hugely physical. It's very gory. I'm probably, you know, I don't know what your reaction will be to this, but at one point there was so much violence, I actually started laughing. I mean, that's not necessarily the intention, but you know, you're seeing a lot of naked flesh and a lot of blood. And there's almost a sort of gory comedy in that, which is how they live their lives.
I have to say, I am seeking always in my life new experiences and things that surprise me. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, walking into the makeup trailer and it being but just wall to wall filled with the largest naked men I've ever seen in my life, just covered in blood and mud. And I was like, wow, that's a real image for 4 a.m. Like, I am not awake enough to deal with this right now.
Great mental image. Perfect description for radio. So thank you for that. I believe, is this right, that when you were making this film, which sounds all-consuming, this is when The Queen's Gambit was coming out and you know, many, many millions of people were watching it.
Absolutely. And I feel very lucky that that's kind of how that went down, because I was so isolated and so removed from everything that for a while it only existed on my phone. And I think the first time I really realized something was different was I've never been on a set where everyone had seen what I'd just done. So I'm getting mic'd up and they're like, hey, I watched the show, it was great. And I was like, oh, thank you. And then it just kept kind of snowballing.
It must have been weird when you went back into the real world though, and were you suddenly aware of that?
Literally dropped into New York, went out for a walk thinking everything was normal, and was back in my apartment an hour later being like, not normal. <That's>, things are different. We're being chased now. Okay, cool. Gotta sort this out.
And how do you do that, Anya? How do you cope, do you think? What's the strategy? Did anyone give you any advice?
Oh yeah, I've been incredibly lucky with people being very generous with their time and their experience. But I honestly think it's just time, because I really am, and I'm not saying this to be, you know, blah or anything like that, but I really didn't get into this job for that side of things. That is something that I'm learning to acclimatize to. And the good news is most people are very, very nice. One person to one person contact, I adore. It's when it's large groups of people and you suddenly realize, oh, I am one person. And I need to try and figure out the situation. But I do think it's just time. And then as I deal with everything, I just work.
Well, I mean, if you will insist on, I don't know, you know, submerging yourself in lakes in Northern Ireland and finding the mud, you'll have that freedom, I'm sure. But I was also loving that you like to go clubbing in Berlin on your own at 11 o'clock in the morning. I've not done that, but it sounds awesome.
You really have to give it a go. It's the greatest thing. When you work this hard, and I'm not saying this like a poor me thing, it's just when you work this hard, you kind of give up the nighttime element of things because you're working really hard. You're putting your body through a lot. So I loved that I was still able to indulge my form of meditation, which is dancing, on a Sunday and have it be a wholesome experience.
Can you still do it with the fame?
A lot of people are super cool. A lot of people are just like, really great to see you. Have a great time. Like, enjoy this. And then, you know, they kind of leave you alone. So sometimes, yes.
And from dancing, and then is chess now part of the meditation in your life?
You know, I had to take a bit of a break from it because I'm so close to Beth that I think if I kept her around in that way, I would never heal from that experience. I know that sounds strange, but I need a bit of distance in order to be able to revisit it again, because otherwise you're just kind of in constant mourning for somebody, and that's quite a heavy place to be in.
But are you good? Are you good at chess now?
I was for a period of time. I'm not sure how good I'll be. It's interesting because you pick up skills depending on what you're doing. So for the Northmen, I was really great at cold exposure. like really great at that. Learned a lot, read a lot of books. I wonder how good I am now.
I was going to say, I also thought you were going to say I was really good at mushroom poisoning after the North, which was also a skill there. The other thing I was just going to ask you about, we are talking on Woman's Hour, is I read that you actually only made friends with those your own age quite recently, and it was older as some of the women in your life that you had those strong bonds with. And a lot of people can relate to that and how important those older women are. And I wanted to ask you about that.
I spent so much of my adolescence feeling very out of place and like there was something very wrong with me. And then it was meeting Kate Dickey and realizing, oh, there's not something wrong with me. I was living in the wrong world. And she and I became so close, and we've lived together over the years multiple times. And we lived together when we made this film. And I think because I'd gone to an all-girls school and I'd had a rough time there, I was slightly afraid of girls my own age. And then through meeting such incredible women that were older, I think it kind of got me over my fear a little bit. And now I have a gorgeous troop of female friends who are just so wonderful and so fierce. It's a different kind of fierceness and loyalty, which I adore.
I think that's fascinating because a lot of people will feel like their school experiences were like that as well, you know, and they have benefited from the intergenerational wisdom of those women around
them. Absolutely. And I really think it's our duty to share the truth with each other. Like I'll give you a very brief example, but I remember a friend of mine was shopping for a wedding dress and she just said, I wish someone had told me that this would be stressful and that I would cry and that my mum would probably drink one glass of champagne too many rather than just hearing, it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be so lovely and sweet and whatever. It's like we have to share about our experiences because otherwise we're all just staying quiet in a vacuum saying, was there something wrong with me that this situation didn't go the way that it's been proposed to us? And not even from us, from society. I think it's important that we talk about all of these taboo subjects that just have not been communicated about.
Anya Taylor-Joy and The Northman is in cinemas from Friday the 15th of April. Hopefully you've got a bit of a flavour of some of the blood, gore and love that is in that film. And it certainly will provoke a reaction if you care to sample it. We've provoked a reaction, which is always what we want to do. From you today, you've really engaged with my question about the questions you would ask of local candidates in the upcoming local elections. And many of you getting in touch because of this new campaign, Respect My Sex If You Want My Ex, asking for people to ask their local candidates for their definition of a woman and their view on single sex spaces. Would you do that, or are there other issues that you are thinking about more? A message here also just saying, I probably wouldn't do this. My questions are about local services. Another one saying, I've already met local candidates. My questions are about the environment, the help for those on lower incomes. In addition, women's rights are hugely important to me. So yes, I did ask about sex as a protected characteristic, the Equality Act, natal males in female sport, single sex spaces. Only one candidate was prepared to engage. She was female and conservative. A message here saying, I do care about the definition of a woman, but it's interesting how there's no debate on the definition of a man. The personal is political, particularly for women. 50% of the population, which is marginalised, abused and raped and murdered and paid less. Why wouldn't we ask our politicians to fully represent us and work for us? On that point, though, to a different point about Rosie Duffield, the Labour MP we were just talking to, Mary says on email, there's a saying, no Pope is going to tell me that I'm not a Catholic. The same thing applies to Rosie Duffield and the Labour Party. It's her Labour Party as well as Keir Starmer's. Another one here saying, yes, I would ask my local candidate about this particular issue, especially around protecting women in toilets and changing rooms. But Sorcha on email says, I completely disagree with the views of J.K. Rowling and the women at that lunch because their language is leading to the attack of my friends. Biological sex is a fact. We cannot ignore this. But this is not the issue. Safety is. I have many trans friends and the main thing they talk about is their daily safety. The constant talk of protecting cis women is what the constant talk is at the moment. And the discussion with trans women's rights, it's giving the false image that trans women are dangerous when in reality they're one of the most persecuted demographic. And Lara says, I've decided women's rights is my number one political issue. And so they continue. Keep those messages coming in. But the artist Celia Paul has written a new book called Letters to Gwen John. Gwen John was a Welsh artist who worked in France for most of her career. Her brother, Augustus John, was the more famous artist during her lifetime, but her beautiful paintings, mainly of female sitters, offer reading in domestic settings, have gained wider attention since her death. Celia Paul shares much in common with Gwen John. Both studied at the Slade. Their paintings have an atmosphere of serenity, and both were models and lovers of older artists. Gwen had a relationship with Auguste Rodin, and Celia with Lucian Freud. And Celia joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why were you drawn to Gwen, and why did you want to write these letters to her?
She's always been very important to me. I've always felt a deep connection to her. But what made me want to write this book now was because my husband, who'd been ill for a long time, was dying of cancer throughout the time I was writing this book. And it was a way of kind of addressing Gwen John's chosen solitude, her loneliness. I'm 62, and a lot of the men, you know, a lot of my men friends of a similar age are kind of who've separated from their wives or their wives have died, are kind of starting again with new families, and this just isn't an option for women. And somehow Gwen's courage about accepting solitude and being empowered by solitude was something that I was inspired by. I've always painted alone. Me and my husband didn't live together, so I've always valued solitude. Mm. But, you know, he died in March 2021, and it's very, very different quality of solitude now.
Yes, well, I'm very sorry about that.
No, it's, it was expected, but yes.
Well, because I know that you also in this book, you talk about being in your 60s. Gwen John, when she was dying at the age of 63, she travelled to Dieppe to try and glimpse the sea for the last time.
Yes.
But you say you also feel like you're running out of time.
Yes, I think, I think any woman who gets to my age, you know, feels suddenly both a kind of liberation that a lot of kind of duties that you were called upon to do have vanished. And you just feel that you need to organise your time more clearly and definitely. You know, you don't need to see people you don't want to see. It's freeing in that way.
You also talk about the frustration of how you are sometimes described as an artist in your own right, because a lot of certainly the media about you, and certainly you've written about this, has centred on your relationship with a man, Lucian Freud.
Yes.
And someone, just to say, for those who aren't familiar with your story, you were first together when you were 18 and he was 56. You had a son together. You were together about a decade or so. And then you married someone else, as you said.
Yes.
But how? Why did you want to talk about that phrase, and why did you want to also relay it in this book with regards to Gwen?
There are lots of artistic professions where women's role is more clearly defined and more secure. Acting, for example, or writing. But painting is a masculine world. And women painters are defined in relation to male painters. Nothing much has changed in that way. There are women painters who paint like men, and they've admitted to it. You know, big gestural paintings. But there are other women like me and like Gwen who, I think, if you saw both of our paintings, you would know instantly that they were painted by women. And
Why?
It's something to do with the interiority, the intensity of the focus, and maybe the smallness of the scale. Gwen Johns' paintings have this incredible power, and yet they're, you know, not much bigger than the size of a book. But on a wall, they kind of knock all the other paintings in a gallery off the walls, because they are so powerful. They're so charged and intense and focused. And you know that she had to kind of live a life of intense focus to be able to produce this work. But I think for both of us, are being kind of associated with more powerful, more famous men has actually given us a kind of overshadowing that has perhaps been quite liberating for us. I think we're neither of us public figures, although here I am speaking on the radio, but, you know, by choice, we're solitary, and somehow we were both involved with celebrities, really, who had a lot of public attention and took that kind of attention away from us, so that in some ways we were able to quietly get on with our work. But the public response is something else that is more difficult to deal with. And I was very shocked after Lucien's death that in a lot of the press articles about his death, I was just referred to as his muse, and it didn't even acknowledge that I was a painter, even though I'd dedicated my whole life to it. And so I thought, I have to actually change this, and the only real way of changing anything is by writing about it. Painting is such a kind of oblique art that it doesn't change things in the same way, although it might gradually over time.
So part of this book and a previous book was an attempt to do that?
Yes, an attempt to do that, yes.
Well, she can't write back. I do like the fact that you end with a handshake to sign off the letters. Why is that?
Well, it's how Vincent van Gogh, on occasion, signed off his letters to his brother Theo. And it stuck in my mind as such a, such a companionable.
Yes. Kind of, I really like it. I may borrow it. I did write a letter by hand last week, but I feel sorry for the recipient because my handwriting is so bad. My left-handed scrawl. Hopefully they'll be able to read it. You can read this. It's typed. It's called Letters to Gwen Johns. Celia Paul, lovely to have you in this kind of studio this morning. Thank you for joining us. And thank you to you for your company. Back tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
There's a story about Vladimir Putin. When he was a teenager, he saw a film that he became obsessed by. He would watch it, all 5 hours of it, over and over again. And decades later, he'd say how important it was to the life he chose. It's called The Shield and the Sword, and it tells the story of a Soviet secret agent working at the highest level in the Nazi war machine. The film prompted Putin to join the KGB. What amazed me, he'd say of the film, was how one man's efforts could achieve what whole armies could not. How one spy could decide the fate of thousands of people. This is the story of a spy who has the fate of tens of millions of people in his hands, told by the men and women who've observed his rise and rise, the Putin experts and the Russia watchers. It's the story of a man who's seen an empire fall and his nation humiliated, and who's torn up the global order trying to restore past glory and avenge the slights of the past. I'm Johnny Diamond, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Putin, the story of the man who's changing the world. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.